Welcome to a very special edition of Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Gina Columbus. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. But today we had the pleasure of sitting down with a group of experts in genitourinary cancers from Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Brigham and Women's Hospital, and Moffitt Cancer Center to discuss a malignancy that is not often an everyday focus, penile cancer. In an effort to share some of the evolving knowledge about penile cancer, the panel took time to highlight research surrounding the overall frequency and prevalence of the disease, current survival outcomes, and available treatment options. The conversation then turned to challenges with existing therapies, recent data that were presented at the recent 2020 AUA annual meeting and 2020 ASCO virtual scientific program. They also shined a light on ongoing research that has the potential to transform the paradigm. Our episode is filled with insights from Guru Sampavde, MD, and Kent W. Mao, MD, both of Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Matthew Mosinen, MD of Brigham and Women's Hospital, Jad Chahoud, MD, and Philip Spies, MD of Moffitt Cancer Center. Let's head to this insightful Onc Live On Air episode right now.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm so excited to have all of you on for a very special episode of Onc Live On Air. We're here today to discuss a very important topic, which is penile cancer. And this is a type of malignancy that really does not garner as much attention as some of the more common tumor types that we all read and research about. And we have a number of experts here today to really shed some light and talk about some of the challenges with patients who have penile cancer, challenges regarding diagnosis and treatment, and point out some of the ongoing research that we're looking at and what the future of this paradigm really looks like. So I'd love to give an introduction to the panelists that we have here today. If you would like to just all go around and state your name and affiliation.
Jad Chahoud, Moffitt Cancer Center, one of the GU medical oncologists.
I'm Dr. Mao, I'm a radiation oncologist at Dana-Farber and Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston.
Brigham and Dana-Farber with Kent and Guru.
Dr. Phil Spies, I'm a GU surgeon at the Moffitt Cancer Center, and I'm an assistant chief of surgical services here.
I'm Guru Sampavde. I'm a medical oncologist at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, focused on GU oncology.
Thank you again for all of you joining today to discuss some of the challenges and the importance of really bringing penile cancer to light here today. I'd really like to first start off with, what is the overall frequency and prevalence of penile cancer? What does diagnosis look like? And are there any kind of diagnostic challenges?
So it's a very rare malignancy. Penile cancer is essentially an orphan disease. We see around 2,000 cases a year in the United States, around 400 deaths a year. So that right there tells you how rare it is in terms of, if you just compare it with lung cancer, where you have around 200,000 cases. So really a very uncommon disease. In terms of, you wanted to get into the etiology, epidemiology, it seems to be a little more common in some developing countries as opposed to developed countries, South America, South Asia. It could be the lack of circumcision at an early age that is an issue. We also know epidemiologically there is an association with HPV in human papillomavirus in 30 to 50% of cases. So not quite a dominant driver like in cancer of the cervix, but still there. We also know there is an association with smoking epidemiologically, as well as with HIV. And so we do need to pay attention to some of these epidemiologic associations, but we still don't understand a lot about the disease and the biology is somewhat obscure. Dr. Chahoud here has done some work on this at MD Anderson that he might want to elaborate on at some point, but we still have a long way to go to understand this disease.
I completely agree with Guru. The numbers are are a bit higher in other developing countries, as you mentioned. The recent data from GlobeCan, which kind of covers global kind of an epidemiological platform for cancers, estimated the numbers around like 35 to 40,000 worldwide, which kind of highlights also the rarity of this cancer. Biology-wise, HPV, as Guru mentioned, it's not similar to cervical cancer where it's like the 99% the main driver of the disease. It seems to be epidemiologically in the U.S., the HPV positive cases tend to be around 30 to 40%, while the HPV negative cases are around 50 to 60% of the cases. There have been a lot of studies looking at the prognostic impact of HPV positive versus HPV negative. It tends to be similar to head and neck squamous cell carcinoma, where we have similar percentages of HPV positivity and where the HPV status now is a major component of staging. It has not impacted yet the amount of treatment in head and neck, so they don't do treatment de-escalation if you're HPV positive, but it downstages the state. So technically stage fours, HPV negatives are stage three, HPV positive in head and neck. We tend to see a similar prognostic relationship in penile cancer, but due to the rarity of the disease, it's been hard to validate these prognostic survival data, as most of the data has been retrospective, small, single or multi-institutional studies, less than 100 patients per study.
I'll just add, in contrast to some of the other rare GU malignancies, I'm thinking particularly of testicular cancer, which can be a disease of younger men. Penile cancer, at least the population that, you know, I think we tend to see here in the U.S., tends to be older. So increasing age, also a risk factor.
I'll add that one of the diagnostic challenges for penile cancer is that it's obviously a very sensitive GU organ and it's pivotal to sexual function. So in order to establish a diagnosis, these patients will need to undergo penile biopsy, partial penectomy, or in some rare cases, even radical penectomy. And that pathology is essential because not only does it stage them, but it can also play into if they need additional surgery or additional chemotherapy. And those other surgeries, inguinal lymph node dissection and pelvic lymph node dissection, which can be a part of the surgical treatment for these patients, also has its own unique set of challenges in this population.
You know, Gina, along those lines, I think what we see clinically oftentimes is patients are often not aware that such tumors unfortunately can develop. And a lot of primary care physicians as well dismiss these as infectious processes. And it's amazing to see how oftentimes patients present in a very delayed fashion, either in the primary tumor or the inguinal lymph nodes, which is the primary echelon that are involved, where the cancer has unfortunately disseminated. And I know we'll discuss in a few moments, you sometimes unfortunately go from a cancer which could have been treated with a highly successful, less morbid treatment, sometimes single modality, whether that be surgery, radiation, or combinations, including medical therapy, versus now treat cancers that are really unfortunately not curative, very symptomatic, and very challenging to truly palliate in these patients.
You all brought up some really excellent points. Thank you so much. I think we covered a little bit about outcomes within those diagnostic and prognosis points. Is there anything else related to outcomes? What current survival rates look like that any of you would like to kind of shed some light on before we go into available treatments?
So I think the surgeons could possibly comment on localized disease, but I will say that about metastatic disease, or unresectable, locally advanced, or metastatic disease, outcomes are quite dismal. It is not a highly chemosensitive malignancy. At the moment for metastatic disease, the standard is a cisplatin-based chemotherapy. There is not a single standard, but we have used TIP, Taxol, ifosfamide, cisplatin, or sometimes cisplatin-5-FU without a taxane, but the outcomes are poor. Median survival is less than a year in most larger cities. There's not a lot of large cities of patients. There's no randomized trials to establish a single standard of care. Salvage therapy with agents available now, again, no randomized trials to establish a single standard. But with taxanes, and sometimes we have given an EGFR inhibitor, cetuximab or panitumumab, given the EGFR overexpression, outcomes overall are poor. in median survival, well less than 1 year in the salvage setting. So really outcomes are poor in that state. I will let the surgeons comment on the localized stages of the disease and where the lymph nodes and the extent of local extent makes a difference to outcomes.
So yeah, you know, along the lines, I would very much agree with Guru. Is really the way to look at this disease is there's localized tumors which are confined to the primary site or to the lymph nodes, low volume. And that's the majority of patients that are ultimately seen with penile cancer. And as Dr. Sambhavdi did an excellent job detailing, is clearly that that's a very different prognosis from the patients with advanced disease. But in terms of what we typically see, and many of my colleagues in the community see, is localized disease is highly treatable, oftentimes with today organ sparing treatments, meaning wide local excision. Radiation in some cases could be an excellent treatment choice. Topical chemotherapy, obviously tailored to the clinical stage and grade of the tumor. And oftentimes patients, you know, have success and outcomes that are outstanding with, you know, survival rates typically over 85%+. When you have early disease in the lymph nodes, oftentimes those patients can similarly potentially be cured, whether that be with surgery or surgery with chemotherapy, sometimes radiation as well in the adjuvant setting. And I would tell you that it's important to highlight here that oftentimes we hear this in the community and among my colleagues, is that surgery for the inguinal lymph nodes used to be associated with a really horrible outcome in terms of complications and morbidity. But now through really minimally invasive surgery, or really, I would say, surgeons that perform a large volume of these cases, patients can have an excellent outcome, and most of these complications could be mitigated before they become really very significant and highly morbid.
Let's go into some of the current treatments that are available for these patients with penile cancer. So there's some surgery, radiation options. What are some systemic therapies that are available? If you could all shed some light on those.
As Phil and Guru have summarized, the disease is divided as localized, locally advanced, metastatic. Highlighting one important caveat that Guru mentioned, that the way we're treating locally advanced patients today is based on a single center phase 2 study that enrolled 30 patients, basing our systemic treatment on neoadjuvant chemotherapy with TIP, followed by consolidation surgery for patients with bulky lymph node metastasis or bilateral lymph node disease. So one important study that I think we need to highlight for our community and other treating physicians is the IMPACT trial. That is trying to answer, it's the first randomized clinical trial for this rare disease that includes, Phil is the lead on that multi-institutional trial. He can talk more about it, but it includes multiple centers across the US that's trying to answer the basic question of what is the best treatment option for, it has two questions, but the main one, the first one is, what is the best treatment modality? Is neoadjuvant chemotherapy the answer, or neoadjuvant concurrent chemoradiation is the answer, or just upfront lymph node dissection followed afterward for patients who have high pathological risk factors with followed by concurrent chemorad. And hopefully this trial would be the basis to improve our understanding of the biology of the disease, HPV positive, HPV negative response. As Guru highlighted, we still are lacking our understanding is not kind of strong on the biology. And hopefully with treating hundreds of patients on that trial, not only will be able to answer the clinical question, but we'll be able to answer some more important question on the biology of the disease and the response and biomarkers and all the things that we have significant better understanding in other more common cancers than we do with penile.
We could switch gears and talk about some of the surgical challenges. So there are several indications for inguinal lymphadenectomy, and this has had historically a lot of morbidity because of the location of the incision. It has a propensity to break down, resulting in a complication that can take many weeks or even months for the patient to recover from. And when the groin gets infected, it can also delay systemic therapy. which is important because this is a multidisciplinary disease, and even more so if we wish to proceed with radiation, because we obviously can't radiate a wound that's healing poorly. Fortunately, there's alternatives. For example, pursuing a robotic inguinal lymph node dissection can be used. It's not necessarily doable in all cases if there's bulky or fixed disease, but it's important to know that this is sort of an additional tool in the toolbox of surgeons that treat a lot of patients with penile cancer. So I think from a surgical perspective, planning the timing of an inguinal lymph node dissection with other therapies and then trying to minimize the morbidity for those patients is one of the most important and yet most challenging aspects of taking care of these patients.
I wanted to ask the surgeons a question about, are any of you doing sentinel lymph node biopsies to guide your lymph node dissection?
Great question, Guru. I did a study on this when I was back many, many moons ago. I'm dating myself here, about 12, 13 years ago when I was a fellow at MD Anderson. And the challenges that we saw is that when you don't do a lot of these operations, the performance of the sentinel lymph node biopsy was not very good. And in the study we had published in the White Journal, Journal of Urology, we had missed two patients who in fact had disease in that groin, but the sentinel node we had harvested was negative. And the way we knew it is we had done sentinel lymph nodes and then we did the actual inguinal lymph node dissection. And so that highlighted to the fact that probably this modality does really quite well in the melanoma world where they do 10 or 20 of these in a given day, or in some parts of Europe, like in UK or the Netherlands, where some of my colleagues over there do 20 or 30 of these a day and they perform in sensitivity specificity over 95%. But it seems in our hands, just because ultimately we don't do necessarily enough of it, we're cautious in ultimately doing it. And I will tell you, I have done them here at Moffitt, and I do them with my melanoma counterparts, and I just think they have much more experience doing it.
I would echo a similar experience, though I don't have as much experience as him. But what I will say is that for centers where you're not doing a high volume of those sentinel lymph node biopsies, it's actually quite difficult to coordinate and to set up the infrastructure. So instead, we might rely on other modalities, so MRI and other sort of occasionally PET CT. So using an obviously physical exam to the extent that the patient's habitus will allow. But again, I echo that we don't really use it that often simply because we don't have that infrastructure and expertise here, I think.
No, I think, Guru, you brought up an important point here as well as we're talking about treatment and optimizing outcomes. And we actually just did a questionnaire of urologic oncologists across North America to see how they care for patients. And unfortunately, the challenge that we're seeing is that most clinicians do not treat the patients in a very standard, consistent pathway. So some patients will have drains in for a few days. Some patients will have drains for a longer period of time. Some patients are put on antibiotics. Some patients are not. So what we're noticing is that because of that, there probably is some heterogeneity. And unfortunately, sometimes patients are probably unfortunately not having optimized outcomes as relate to that. And I think I do congratulate our counterparts in many places in Europe, for example, where they do have super regionalization of care and therefore see volumes. And I know clearly we do have some centers like that, like your center, like my center, like MD Anderson, that see that. But I think there are some opportunities to improve patient outcomes by doing that.
Great. I can just, I guess maybe briefly to round out the multimodality, sort of treatment paradigm, talk a little bit about radiation techniques. As, other speakers have alluded to, considering the primary tumor separately from the nodes. And so, either the primary tumor and or the lymph nodes can potentially be radiated. To focus just for a minute on the primary tumor, unlike some disease sites where I would say the standard for radiation setup and delivery is very sort of commonly used and formulaic. Here, for penile cancer, depth of invasion, location of the tumor, patient body habitus, all of these things really, I think, play into how we choose to radiate the primary tumor for the subset of men who qualify for that. And so for that reason, a variety of different radiation techniques have been used. Again, I'm going to preface this by saying I would say all of these are rare, particularly in the U.S., but for relatively superficial tumors, there are brachytherapy methods. These have been used widely in Canada and in parts of Europe. Interstitial brachytherapy, where catheters are inserted perpendicular to the long axis of the penis, and then patients are treated with typically a high dose rate brachytherapy as an inpatient. For more superficial tumors, there are surface brachytherapy devices and applicators that can be used to deliver dose, you know, to a relatively shallow depth for those more superficial tumors. And then for the nodes, you know, this is, you know, something in many ways that can resemble treatment of inguinal and pelvic nodes for other types of disease that we more commonly radiate. So things like cervical cancer, vulvar cancer, you know, other gynecologic and GI malignancies, we can, you know, sort of take the advances that have been made in those spaces and apply them to our penile cancer patients. And for that reason, you know, I think we're now probably more safely and more with less toxicity able to treat inguinal, pelvic, sometimes even periaortic nodes in these patients. And, you know, clearly, you know, unfortunately, there's not always great data to drive these decision-makings, you know, these treatment decisions. And so we have to be careful because we can deliver something, we have to still think carefully about, you know, what benefit that can provide for the patients.
Maybe I'll just mention the novel approaches then. I think you heard about the neoadjuvant therapy role for TIP chemotherapy in locally advanced bulky disease. There is also this question of adjuvant therapy that comes up in patients who had resection. And I do consider adjuvant therapy in high-risk patients, usually more than one lymph node or extra nodal extension, bilateral, anything more advanced than one lymph node is where I consider that. And in that situation, I would also discuss the issue of adjuvant chemoradiation therapy combination. Although again, we don't have phase 3 data to tell us which of these components is more important. Do we need both? And in the issue of systemic therapy, so there's platinum-based chemotherapy and salvage therapy. Everything is an unknown with the lack of phase 3 trials. But in the salvage setting, we have used taxanes. There is the NCCN guidelines talking about some case reports, case series, looking at cetuximab or panitumumab. We've looked at checkpoint inhibitors, which are the rage right now in many different cancers with T-cell checkpoint inhibitors. Unfortunately, this is a disease in which the mutation burden seems a little low. PD-L1 expression is high, yet they're not so responsive to checkpoint inhibitors so far. We did a study with ipilimumab, nivolumab in rare GU cancers. This was a poster discussion at ASCO recently, a couple months back. And unfortunately, in the few penile cancer cases we had, the responses were not spectacular at all. So it's somewhat been disappointing. However, the combination of cabozantinib with nivolumab plus or minus ipilimumab look somewhat more interesting. Again, a small number of cases in a study done by the NCI. So that may be something of interest where you come in with multiple combinations hitting different targets.
No, I think you've covered most of the data that we recently have. We also have some data with single agent pembrolizumab as part of a multi-cohort of solid tumors. Similar response rate with 1 out of 3 patients having a good partial response and then being able to go on consolidation surgery and having a long disease-free interval. We have had a couple of experiences with personal patients that we have that had high tumor mutational burden above 10, a couple of them that had really impressive response to single agent IO, but as Guru highlighted, tumor mutation burden more than 10 in one of our studies at Anderson and another study tend to be around like 15 to 20% of patients only. PD-L1 is highly expressed, but we don't have enough data to know if it's enough of a biomarker. As Guru highlighted, most probably we will need to understand more about the biology, maybe more of combination. We recently developed at MD Anderson in collaboration with our partners at Notre Dame a mouse model of penile cancer where we've tested immune checkpoint combination and we've looked at the immune microenvironment in penile cancer. The response rate of the immune microenvironment tend to be a cold immune microenvironment with high MDCs and low CD8 TILs. We looked at immune checkpoint combination alone with PD-L1 inhibitors alone. We did not have much tumor kill. When we added cabozantinib and the COX-2 inhibitor, we saw a better significant tumor kill, which also correlated with the clinical, with the small clinical data that we have from NCI with improved response rate with nivo and cabozantinib. But as Guru highlighted, we still need to know more on how to improve this combination of immune checkpoint blockades plus different agent, different targeted agents.
One interesting approach is the NCI is doing a study on HPV positive tumors in using T cells that are engineered to attack these HPV proteins, right? That looks interesting.
Yes. So Dr. Rosenberg group reported like in JCO last year, a paper on like the feasibility of that. They had, I think, 3 out of 10 really good responders. That's what I do with my patients. As soon as I come the door, knowing that they have bulky lymph node or high lymph node burden, what I do is HPV testing. We have a whole solid tumor HPV TCR trial. So I just, and I HLA type them also, get PD-L1 staining, get information on tumor mutational burden, other potential targeted mutations. Because you're thinking, you're trying to plan when my chemo is going to fail. We know the response rate with neoadjuvant chemo is around 50%, and even those 50%, half of them will relapse later. So having that information on hand early on is helpful in disease that tends to have multiple wound complication, aggressive, and kind of runs ahead of us. That's one of the strategies that I try and think of as an option for HPV-positive patient if they have the right HLA.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this special episode of Onc Live On Air. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. Onc Live is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at Onc Live and at Onc Live SOSS. On Facebook, like us at Onc Live and Onc Live State of the Science Summit, and follow our Onc Live page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of Onc Live On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to Onc Live On Air.